Everything is about lessons, right? We're going to keep on learning lessons every single day. Life is about learning lessons. If you don't learn the lesson, it's simple to know because it results in pain.
This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook.
A great way to teach lessons and stories is just tell mine. It's a little bit unique. I grew up in Akron, Ohio, the armpit of the U.S., great place to be from. And I had a single mom. My dad left when I was 5, and she raised 6 kids, 5 boys and a girl. And my mom had one simple philosophy in life: doctor, lawyer, or failure. That's all I literally ever heard. In fact, she did not believe that the fetus was fully developed till after graduate school. But the amazing thing about my mom, typical Jewish mom, you know, but she was a black belt in the martial arts. She was one of the few third-degree black belts in the martial art of Jewish guilt. And so she drove us. My siblings are parents' wet dreams. Me, not so much. But they went to Harvard, Penn, Columbia. Some of them live around here. So if you look up my last name, don't tell them that you met their brother. They'll be embarrassed. But she was the best mom in the world. And honestly, I'm complete mama's boy. I'll have trouble getting through my story without crying about my mom because she was that amazing. She worked 2 jobs. She was a second grade teacher, packed our dinners in a paper bag, and then filled turnstiles at the 7-Elevens and convenience stores just so we could eat. Made sure that we studied. My siblings, like I said, were great academics. I personally wanted to be a professional football player. And I had one skill. I could run scared faster than anyone could angry. And I had a 2-bedroom apartment with 6 kids and 4 brothers, so I really learned to juke and jive fairly well. Worked really hard, and that's where I learned my definition of happiness, because although we didn't have any money, I was super happy. Really happy kid, and that's why I adore my mom. With looking back with all that I didn't have, I had more than what most people have today. And I was so happy. The only time I wasn't happy, though, is I would catch my mom crying over financial stress. Right, a car would break down, summer camp, there's things I could just, and it broke my heart. So at the age of 5, I decided that I was gonna make a lot of money to buy my mom a house and a car. That's all I wanted to do. I was gonna be a professional football player, buy her the house and the car, and F my siblings, they can study. That's how I was gonna be the favorite child. And I did, I had this definition. I always enjoyed the consistent every day, persistent without quit, pursuit of my potential. And looking at me, you can imagine my football potential. But I did get a scholarship to college, which was surprising even to me. And I remember the first football game as a freshman. I was the fastest one on the team. So they put me as a bullet on the kickoff team as a freshman, my very first play. I weighed 147 pounds, and I haven't shrunk, so I'm about this tall then. I remember flying down the field thinking that first kickoff, oh, this is it, the start of my professional career. And I flew down, and sure enough, just like any other time, I got down there first, and I just nailed the ball carrier. I ripped into him, and the next thing I know, I was flying backwards, landing on my back, and the guy actually stepped on me. I was lying there thinking to myself, doctor, lawyer, or failure? Fuck, I picked the wrong profession. And luckily for me, that guy that ran me over was a guy named Christian Okoye. Yeah, nickname was Nigerian Nightmare. He was the AFC Player of the Year the next year. But nonetheless, I decided I better really take academics seriously. Immediately started studying. I was pre-med. At the end of the season, I went to visit my brother who was doing his residency and learned a great lesson, because I went in there like every great 18-year-old and I told my brother, man, I hate hospitals. He's like, what? Dave, you're pre-med, you hate hospitals. I'm like, I'm not gonna be a doctor in a hospital, I'm gonna be a sports doctor. Fields, training rooms, what do I need to be in a hospital for? And he looked at me and he said, David, you need to be more interested than interesting. And that was truly a valuable lesson. When I ran the most notable sports agency in the world, and still today, people come up to me and say, oh, Mr. Meltzer, I wanna be a sports agent just like you. And that's the first thing out of my mouth. You know, do you really know what you're talking about? You need to be more interested than interesting, especially today, because there's so much data out there. There's so much information. And if we don't know what information and vet that information correctly that we need, we're in really big trouble. And so I press upon myself every day to ask the other questions, to ask more questions, to figure out how interested I am in what I'm doing. It also formulates into a mathematical equation of what you pay attention to put your intention to equals the coincidences in your life, which is a mathematical occurrence. When two angles collide as a perfect angle, it's a coincidence, right? So it's a mathematical occurrence. And I have all these great coincidences. People say I'm busy. I say I'm active. I believe in activity you get paid for, activity you don't get paid for. I master time through that concept of attention and interest. Anyway, I immediately switched my profession to lawyer to satisfy my mom. And when I went to law school, another lesson that I learned was I reverse engineered everything. I saw that a lot of people my age, when I was going to law school, they were going to law school because their parents really wanted them to. They're going to law school because they didn't have anything else to do. They're going to law school and they thought they'd figure out what they would do in law school. I went to law school to be rich. There's no doubt. I told my mom, I'm going here because lawyers make money. And so I literally looked up what type of lawyers made the most money graduating law school, and it was an oil and gas litigator. And so I went to Tulane Law School, despite I got into other law schools, because they had the top maritime law program and they had the most graduates that worked for oil companies. And I literally, that's the only reason I wanted to go to law school, to buy my mom this house and a car. When I graduated law school, I actually had two job offers, which was even more surprising to me. One to be an oil and gas litigator, which probably would have afforded me enough money to buy a house and a car for my mom. Maybe not in San Diego where she moved us out to, but at least in Louisiana, okay. Akron, Ohio. No, but then I also got a job offer selling legal research on the internet. And this is the early 90s, so the internet was nothing like it is today. And I remember distinctly trying to decide what to do. And I asked my mom, my great advisor, what should I do? I really want to be rich. What job should I take? And without blinking, of course, she said, you need to be a real lawyer. You know, this internet thing, it's a fad. You don't do it. Lesson number two, and probably one of the most valuable lessons, is just because somebody loves you, and trust me, my mom still loves me too much, like most Jewish moms, just because someone loves you doesn't mean they give you good advice. And it's really important because we don't always find the people that sit in the situation that we want to be in. We a lot of times rely on advice from people that have no effing clue what they're talking about. My mom knows what she's talking about as a teacher, but not as business or the internet. So I also think that a lot of times we vote for what other people want for us, and then we resent them when it's elected into our lives. And so at that time was the first time I voted for what I wanted. And so I went into the internet. 9 months out of law school, I was a millionaire. I had a $250,000 comp plan, and I made $1 million in 9 months. And a lot of people ask me, if you're not thinking of it, shame on you, how the hell did you do that? I was 24 years old, and I think it's important because I've run my life this way, especially with money, is that I took a formula and started looking and saying to myself, gosh, if I work twice as productive as everyone else, if everyone's productive for 8 hours, what if I could be productive for 16 hours a day? And what if I worked on the efficiency of that time? I could have 32 hours of productivity a day. And what if I was more statistically successful at it? I could have 64 hours of productivity in a day. So I would have 8 days of productivity every day. And because I don't believe in work, I believe in finding and loving what I do, learning what I love to do, learning to love what I do, finding the light, love, and lessons in everything I do, and took that attitude because all I wanted to do was be rich, to buy my mom a house and a car. So everything for me was focused. I remember praying to God my third year in law school before I got a job offer and had $100,000 of law loans. I remember praying to God saying, God, if you allow me to buy my mom a house and a car and pay back my law loans, I will shovel shit with my hand 6 days a week, 12 hours a day with gratitude. Yeah. That's how focused I was. And I didn't care. And I still, if that was the case, that's not a problem. And I don't think kids today may have that same toughness in them. They definitely don't know how to use a telephone, which is my second irk. if you teach your kids two things, teach them toughness and telephone, and they'll be so far advanced over any other competition out there. I really mean that. Anyway, I went ahead and reverse engineered that to work 7 days, or activity I got paid for 7 days. So it was 56 days. The funniest thing I said is I won all these awards, obviously, for killing my comp plan. And they rewarded me. I learned another lesson as a salesperson. They reward you when you do really well by cutting your territory and raising your quota. So like at 25, I was like, what the fuck? I thought I did a good job. Why are you cheating me out of my money? But I looked at that and I told them, I'm like, oh, I don't know why I'm getting all these awards. I didn't even hit my comp plan. And they're like, what are you talking about? You blew everyone else away. I said, well, I worked 10 years, you know, for 100 grand a year. I really didn't hit it. And I really did. I was productive, 10 years of production in just 9 months. Now, I did buy my mom a house and a car, which was one of the greatest moments of my life. It also was a really bad moment because it just reinforced one thing. I truly believe that money bought love and it bought happiness. I was really happy and I was the favorite child of my mom for the first time. I really believe that. And so everything in my life from 25 on was about money. And I didn't know, I branded myself. We sold the company in 1995 for $3.4 billion, which was a lot of money in 95. And that changed the trajectory of my life. I started, instead of branding myself, I was so insecure about not being a real lawyer. My mom made me take the bar, by the way, and I passed that. I used to keep the ESQ on my business cards. And my mom was worse than me about the insecurity. They'd say, oh, what does your son do? Oh, he's a corporate lawyer. He works for a publisher. I was like, I've never practiced a day of law in my life. But I literally lived my life at that time about money, and it kept on getting reinforced because I branded myself a technology guru. I went up to the Silicon Valley and I learned a valuable lesson, how to raise money, which still today I think is the greatest gift that I and skill set that I have. You will never go broke if you know how to raise money. And I was on Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road, Texas Pacific, Amarendo, Sequoia, in my 20s, raised $169 million, overselling, back-end selling, manipulating, and lying, and cheating, like every great sales rep, I thought. But I was driven by money, and I ended up at 32 being the CEO of Samsung's first phone division. No engineering background at all, just a great salesperson. And we had the world's first smartphone. It was a Windows CE device. They told me it was too big and too expensive. Now look who's laughing, right? Shit, I got like six of those phones. But I literally still reinforce. I ended up marrying my dream girl, my wife. My wife and I met in the fourth grade. My mom moved us out here, all six of us. She said, if we're gonna be poor, we might as well be poor in San Diego, not Akron. And so I lived down the street from Julie, and I fell in love with her when she went skateboarding by my house. I asked my best friend at sixth grade camp if he would help and ask her to go steady with me at sixth grade camp. Of course, she said no, tell him to ask me himself. So I threw an egg at her. And then she hated me for years and years and years and stayed as far away from me. Once again, fortunately, she married me. So at 32 years old, I had everything. I lived in Rancho Santa Fe. We had a golf course, a ski mountain, homes, Ferrari, Porsche, motorhome, boats. I really believe money bought happiness. Three things happened that were really life-changing for me. At 30 years old, my father, who left when I was 5, was my hero. In fact, I carry a lot of guilt because I remember asking my mom, it was the 70s, my dad was kind of a deadbeat daddy, although he was wealthy and he married a girl closer to my age than his. He didn't pay my mom child support. And then the 70s, that was a little different. And I was the smart ass in the back saying, Mom, why aren't you more like Dad? And he's being wild. My mom's working two jobs, packing my dinner. And she never said a word negative about my father to me until I was 10 and he forgot my birthday. And when he forgot my birthday, it was hard enough. But when I asked him why, he said, I didn't forget your birthday. I don't believe in birthdays. And I was smart enough at 10 to realize that my dad was a liar, a cheater, a manipulator, overseller, and back-end seller. And I didn't want to talk to him anymore. But at 30 years old, my dad sent me a birthday present for the first time in 20 years. And it was a beautiful box, and it had a sport coat in it, and it fit, obviously, better than this one. But it meant that he either called my wife or my mom and got my sizes. I was almost in tears when I opened it, because I couldn't believe that my dad was forgiving himself. I couldn't believe that he was starting to understand my life, and you know, here was this beautiful gift, and he was admitting that he believes in birthdays. I took it out, I put it on, but he had torn out all the pockets, all the lining. So I called him immediately, and I'm like, Dad, why would you ruin the jacket that you got me for my birthday? He said, it's not for wearing. I was like, what's it for? He said, to remind you that you're just like me. I'm like, what, that you're an asshole? Like, I couldn't figure it out. Literally, I was like, why do you torture me? I've waited 20 years for a gift and this is what you give me? He goes, it's not for wearing. Hang it in the closet to remind you that you're just like me. I'm worried about you. So why are you worried about me? I have everything. I married my dream girl. I have three beautiful daughters. I live in Rancho City. I have everything. I'm nothing like you. You're a liar, cheater, manipulator, overseller, back and forth. I'm nothing like you. He said, hang it in your closet. I don't want you to be the richest man in the cemetery. I want you to know that you can't take anything with you when you're gone. I want you to be buried in that jacket and remind you of me because I made those mistakes. I don't want you to. I was pissed, too young to understand what he was saying. Years later, when we lived here, I got a job with Lee Steinberg, Sports and Entertainment. I had left the phone business, and this to me was a dream job. Right, my office was between Lee Steinberg and Warren Moon, looking over Catalina Island on Newport Center Drive. Being a frustrated athlete, I couldn't believe that I was actually working there. And I started doing dumb things. There was a lot of exposure. I surrounded myself with the wrong people, the wrong ideas. And my best friend, who asked my wife to go steady, he wasn't hanging out with me anymore. And so I took him out golfing. I'm like, hey man, how come you don't hang out with me? He said, I really don't like who you hang out with. I said, oh, well, you know, I'm not like those guys. He goes, you're not like those guys? Yeah, I'm not doing what they're doing. He goes, really? He goes, you can lie to me, David, but don't lie to yourself. And I went home from that golf match crying because I knew he was truthful. I knew it was the truth. And I didn't like myself and I didn't like the people I was around, even though everyone around me thought I was incredible, which made it even worse because I felt like the biggest fraud in the world running around. And then 2 weeks later, I was at the Grammy Awards with a rapper, a guy named Little John. And I was partying, drinking, probably high. And I lied to my wife. She knows this already, so this is okay. I lied to her and told her I had a business meeting. Now she tells me she actually saw me take the other clothes into the car with me and she knew I was lying. I was probably too stupid and arrogant at the time to realize how stupid and arrogant I was, but I changed clothes, went to the Grammy Awards, came home, and there she was to tell me she wasn't happy. She told me to take stock in who I was and what I wanted to become, and if not, she was gonna leave. My initial reaction, I wish I could have told you, was forgiving, but it wasn't. My initial reaction was, are you effing kidding me? Who do you think you are? Look at this house, look where I live. Look at our cars. What the hell are you talking about? So I went into the room. I woke up in the morning, and I wish I could tell you I thought any differently. I started looking, thinking, who'd I go to law school with? What great lawyer could I take everything and get divorced? And I really did. I was so mad. I had such a need to be offended. I had such a need to be superior and inferior at the same time. I was so bent into an ego-based consciousness. It's hard for me even to admit it, but I sat there thinking about getting divorced, and then I looked in my closet, and I still remember seeing it, because I looked, and there was that goddamn jacket. It still chokes me up, because I remember thinking to myself, man, I'm a liar, cheater, back-end seller, overseller, and I'm just like my dad. And that's when it hit me that I better take stock in who I was. And so I did. And I started listing out all the different things. And I came up with four things that have driven my life ever since and shifted the paradigm of my entire life to where I am today. The first was gratitude. I lost my gratitude and I teach gratitude. I'm known anyone that watches the videos and everything. I think it's the dumbest thing ever for two reasons. Some people say I stole gratitude from Gary Vee or they... Or other people say I change their life because I tell them to say thank you before they go to bed and when they wake up. But I will tell you, as Brian Smith, who's here, is one of my mentors, I'm around some of the greatest thought leaders of all time, like Brian and Jack Canfield and Bob Proctor and Mary Morrissey and, you know, people who know physics, quantum physics, metaphysics, John Assaroff, and we all agree gratitude is the most powerful thing in the world. And if you want to change your life in 0.1 seconds every day, just say thank you. If you can say it for 30 straight days, it'll become a habit. It's the best habit that you can ever have. It'll change your life, guaranteed. Anyone here think they can say thank you for 30 straight days? Yeah. That's the saddest part about speaking around the world is that everybody says no problem. But by the time you go to sleep tonight, half of you won't say thank you. By tomorrow morning, another half of you won't say thank you. And within 3 days, almost all of us won't say thank you. I've given you a secret to life that you've known since you were a child, yet we're so far in our own way that we won't say thank you. And it's such a powerful thing. So I just started to say thank you for everything. Started to find the light, the love, the lessons in everything, which is a gracious way to live. I started to be kind to my future self by doing good deeds. Simple little deeds like picking up trash and putting carts back and saying thank you and looking people in the eyes and opening doors and just changing my energy for everything. The second thing that I wrote down was forgiveness or empathy. You can't give what you don't have, I say. And so I just wanted to forgive myself so I could forgive everyone else. And so I live with forgiveness. Gratitude gives me perspective. Forgiveness gives me peace. And then accountability. That's a really big one for me. My mom always talked about living below the line in blame, shame, and justification. Well, I was living way below the line. And I learned two simple questions. If you want to be accountable and take control of your life, just continually ask yourself, what did I do to attract this to myself, and what am I supposed to learn from it? Everything is about lessons, right? We're going to keep on learning lessons every single day. Life is about learning lessons. If you don't learn the lesson, it's simple to know because it results in pain. Physical pain, mental pain, spiritual pain, emotional pain. If you have pain, it just means you haven't learned the lesson yet. Here's the interesting thing about lessons. You are going to forget every lesson you've ever learned. So remember that if you can. And two, you have the ability, especially today, to access every lesson that's ever been taught and hasn't been taught yet. You have the ability to access every lesson. Finally was inspiration. I called it effective communication then, but the big paradigm shift in my life was I thought I needed to get motivated, right? I thought I was motivated, and I started to realize that I'm already connected to the biggest source of energy, light, and love, and lessons that exist at all times. And it's just a matter of how much interference or corrosion to that connection that I have before I allow it to come through me for others and inspire them. And there was three worlds that I was looking at. I started looking when I was a child. I lived in a world of not enough. And believe it or not, some people that live in homes like this, they live in that world still. There's never enough. It's a scarce world. It's a sad world. It's an interfered world. It's one in which I hope some of you could help other people realize you don't have to live in a world of more than not enough. Then there's the world that I lived in was the world of just enough. A lot of people live in this world. I did. I thought, man, everything happens for me. And there's just not enough of me. There's just enough all the time. Just enough, and then you want more. For me, I shifted the paradigm of my entire life to live in a world of more than enough. I make room for everything that I want so it can come through me for other people. I add appreciation to that so it adds value. And we talked about value earlier. So I took these values and created something that applies to being an entrepreneur, applies to being a parent. And here's the five things that I'd like to teach, and then we'll take some Q&A. Number one, know your own values, right? It took me the best thing in my life to figure out what my values truly were and what I wanted to live for. But every morning I wake up and I look at my personal values, my experiential values, my giving values and receiving values, and they're never balanced. There's no balance of values. But I determine every day what my values for that day are. And it allows me to be productive, accessible, and gracious in every instance. It allows me to make quick decisions. It allows me to know who I am. So there's no question about where I'm going or what I'm doing or who I want to hang out with. I know my values and remind myself every morning. Two, you guys talked about earlier what makes this group so powerful. I give a little bit of an enhancement to it. I call it the ask and attract. People don't ask. The first thing that they don't ask is they don't know how to ask a series of questions of how to be of service or of value. So you need to learn every day to ask a series of questions. Usually start with an open-ended questions and utilize closed-ended questions in order to lead people to what value you can provide them. But you should always, in every interaction, in person, on the phone, via email or media, radio, print, TV, social media, ask a series of questions of how you can provide value. That's one thing, and everyone loves that. But the hardest part is the second series of questions, which I find most people don't ask because they don't understand radical humility. Radical humility will dictate the fact that you should be asking a series of questions of, do you know anyone that can help me? Asking for help is the most humble thing that you can do. It creates a flow. It creates, and like I said, makes room for what you want. You'll be amazed when you ask people if they know anyone that can help you, what happens in your life. Giving's easy. Receiving is difficult. Most people don't feel worthy of what they have right now, let alone something else or ask for more. You have to learn to ask. Feel confident in what you're going to do with what you receive, and you'll feel better about receiving. That helped me. So knowing your values, number two, asking and attracting. Three is a time one. I'm a huge fan of being a student of my calendar, right? Attention plus intention equals coincidences. So every day I study my calendar. That's not looking at my calendar. I study it. I study it with a lens of productivity. How much value can I provide? I study with a lens of accessibility. How accessible am I to all of you and to others? But also, what am I accessing in my life? And then a lens of gratitude. Always finding the light, the lessons, the love in what I'm doing. And I study what I'm doing every day in person, on the phone, via email and media, but also the white space of my calendar. Most people don't take the time to study what they're not doing. And if you really want to be productive and accessible and gracious, study it. Pay attention to it. Watch what happens. The coincidences will start occurring. And then even more importantly than the white space, study sleep. The only coach that I have at all times is a sleep coach. I always carry a sleep coach. Anytime I travel, I'm calling her and asking her, what time should I go to sleep? When should I eat? What time should the light be on? Whatever it is, I'm coached by an expert on how to utilize the time that's spent getting out of my own way, subconscious and unconsciously. It's the number one habit that we all share and spend the most time doing. And yet 99.9% of the people don't pay any attention to their sleep. Study it. Study it. It'll be change your life. It changes mine. The energy will just come through you. So be a student of your calendar. The fourth thing that was always confusing for me, I did a meetup earlier at our beach house, and there's a gentleman who brought his son. He must have been 16 or 17. So I asked him, hey, can you tell me what being present means to you? And he actually had a really good answer about living in the now. I was pretty impressed for a 16 or 17-year-old. And I said, well, how do you effectuate living in the now? And of course, that stumps him, because it usually stumps everybody, because people worry about their why too much. Do you know that? Everybody, billions of dollars are made on, hey, I'll help you find your why. You got passion and purpose. That's bullshit. You all know your why. It's to help somebody with something. That's your why. You may not know what that is, but you know your why. You're here to help others. And it drives you, and every one of you know within you, but it's the what that confuses us, because we don't even know our what. We don't think about the what. So to be present, what does that mean? Do it now. You want to change your life, do things now. I'm a sports person, so I always love, 100% of all short putts never go in. You may have heard that before. Has anybody seen differently? Because I'm still trying to figure out that one. Brian, you ever hit a short putt that went in? Nope. But even more importantly, 100% of things that you do now get done. That's a huge mathematical advantage over everyone else on earth, to get things done. So I ask myself all the time the first question, can I do it now? And if so, I do it. And if I can't do it, it goes into a repository, a list, a folder, some place that I'm going to go back to, where I prioritize it like Roosevelt taught, by what's most important first and then what's urgent. If something's just urgent, just delegate it, right? Just delegate it. But I have a list that I knock things off all the time just by importance, and I stay present by doing things now and maximizing my statistical success by doing them. I never forget anything that I do now, and I always do it. So the last one is the most complex, and I think it's the thing that will make us most successful. Is I call it practicing ending fear. If I could change the world, I think mentioned earlier, my mission in life is to impact over 1 billion people to be happy. I think we have a huge happiness problem. I've read and studied and write books on happiness because I can't believe the statistics of the fastest growing cause of death in the world is suicide. The number one cause of death in certain age groups, and as we are a cross-generational group, is suicide. Right? This is crazy. I read an article about college graduates. Some of us in this cross-generational group have college kids. When we graduated college 30 years ago, 10% of all graduates were depressed, anxious, or suicidal that graduated college. Today, 90%. From the American psychology, there's a huge happiness problem. So I decided, I spent 30 years trying to figure out how I could make over $1 billion, by the way. I thought, I gotta figure this out. I know I can do it, I have the capability. I can never do it. When Bezos made over $100 billion, it was perplexing to me. I was blessed to meet Steve Jobs, and he talked about always connect the dot backwards. Once you can connect the dot backwards, you have that vision, you can execute on it. I couldn't even get to over $1 billion. I made, and you know, didn't mention this, but 2 years after my wife kicked my ass and I changed, we lost all our money. We lost on paper, she likes when I say on paper, over $100 million. It was no joke. Best thing that ever happened to me, not to her, but completely. But moving towards that, I said, you know, if I'm gonna change, how do I make over $1 billion? Couldn't figure it out. And then I decided, you know what? What if I just try to change over 1 billion lives, to impact over 1 billion people? That was like this to me, and people actually believe I can do it. Because I started realizing I have TV shows, podcasts, movies, stages, all these great places where I could just look in my lifetime for 1,000 people like you. And that's why I'm here tonight. I'm looking for 1,000 people that feel as if they can impact 1,000 people to impact 1,000 people. 1,000 times 1,000 is a million times 1,000 is a billion. Imagine if we can impact 1 billion people to be happy. What the collective consciousness would create in this country, in this world. 1 billion people that are happy every day, that are finding the light, the love, and the lessons in everything that they do, that are abundant, that are doing good deeds, that are kind. These are simple things that are effects of being happy. And I think the more you think about it individually, the more we think about it collectively, the more we pay attention to it and start putting our intention to it, the greater the coincidence of happiness will occur. And I'm seeing it already, and I'm blessed, and I think truly that it's a reality for me. So I created the fifth one, which is practice ending fear. Everybody has fear. Fear is an ego-based consciousness. It's created by the need to be right, the need to be offended, the need to be separate, inferior, superior, anxious, frustrated, all of these different great feelings that we have. And just understand, it's just a practice. That's all it is. You're never going to get rid of it. If I could change the world, one invention, I'd give an egoectomy to all of you. And then fear would end, and we'd all live in truth-based consciousness. The problem with fear and ego is not only does it take you off of a trajectory that you want to be on, creating a void, a shortage, an obstacle in your life, an interference or corrosion to that wonderful connection that you all have. The problem with the ego and fear is it's an accelerant, right? Offense, all these separations, inferiority, anger, frustration, they cause us to accelerate, where truth creates calmness, right? It slows things down for us. We're at peace, where when we're in ego-based consciousness, we accelerate. And the other problem with fear is that people confuse it as a motivator. A lot of you think that fear motivates you. It does not motivate anyone. It's the biggest soul sucker of energy that's ever been created. What it will do is focus you. And like I said, if you get focused, you'll have a short-term positive result by being focused, right? Consistent, persistent behavior, or attention plus intention. That's focus, but it's gonna suck your soul and drain your energy. So you have to figure out a way to keep practicing getting back to center and ending fear. I'll give you a quick example, and then I'll take some Q&A if we have time, or just cut me off and I'll go home. We're good still? Okay. Here's an example, cross-generational example of how powerful this is. I have two routines. I have a home routine when everything's perfect, right? I wake up the same time, 4 a.m., I meditate 20 minutes, 10 minutes, get ready, go to the gym for an hour, come back, have an hour of research, hour with the family, go take 3 coaching calls, get to the office as a student in my calendar, execute till 4:45, coaching calls, get home, 5:30 to 7:30 is phones off, email off, everything off, family time, 7:30 to 9, study, research, family time, whatever I want, 9 o'clock, put my 9-year-old to bed, and boom, intimate time with my wife, and try to stay up to 11. So I wake up at 4 a.m., I meditate for 20 minutes, I'm in a perfect place, get ready, I'm going to the gym, it's Saturday morning, and I walk outside, and my 17-year-old daughter's car is missing. I immediately grab my cell phone, and I'm about 6 numbers into the number, and I'm about to swear at her and do everything that I feel, and I stop, right? I'm in ego-based consciousness, and I'm practicing stopping this. And so instead of yelling at her, where the are you? Where the is your car? I gently call her back and say, hey, where are you? She said, in my room. I said, oh. She goes, why? I go, because your car's not here. She said, oh, because you told me when the kids were drinking that I should Uber home. Now, I'm smart enough to know kids are drinking means she was drinking. She forgot who she was talking to. Little John's friend. So I was like, oh, okay. I go, I am so sorry for waking you. Oh, I love you, Daddy. Okay, thank you. Now, that may seem insignificant in the lessons of practicing ending fear, but I'll tell you what normally happens. I call, where the F are you? Where the F is your car? Well, you told me, blah, 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 back and forth. So what happens the next time kids are drinking? She decides to drive home. Life changes completely in so many different directions in ego-based consciousness as an accelerant, creating void shortages and obstacles and interference and corrosion to the most powerful light and lessons and love that you could have. That, to me, is the most pragmatic example of my life of practicing ending fear. And I do it in business, I do it with my kids. And if you can practice ending fear and teach people their values and these five things, you can impact them simply to be happy with where they're at in the enjoyment of the consistent, persistent pursuit of their potential. And if you can do that, if just you can impact for yourself 1,000 people to impact 1,000 people, that will make a collective consciousness of happiness, and that certainly will make me happy. Hope you enjoyed this episode of The Playbook, but more importantly, I want you to join my text community. I'm doing a lot of fun things there, one-on-one conversations, trainings, giveaways, and it's the first place I release all of the information that I'm giving. So join me at my text platform, 949-298-2905. That's 949-298-2905. Join my exclusive community.